Good morning, Second Church. Let's stand and be called into worship with this reading drawn from the great story of Elijah in the mountain. When the Lord passed by Elijah, there was a great and mighty wind, splitting mountains and shattering rocks by the power of the Lord. The wind after the wind, an earthquake.
But the Lord was not in the
earthquake. After the earthquake, fire.
But the Lord was not in the fire.
And after the fire, a soft, murmuring sound. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his mantle about his face and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave, and a voice addressed him.
Why are you here, Elijah?
I am led by zeal for the Lord, the God of hosts, for our people have forsaken your covenant, and I alone am left.
And the Lord said to him, go back, I will again.
In the spirit of all who have gone down from the mountain to serve, let us worship the Lord.
Prayer of confession. The child makes many a mistake, but the mother forgives them all. I am your child, your wayward child. Lord, won't you forgive my sin? My mind is trapped in a depression. And how can I free my mind without your name? I am your child, your wayward child. Lord, won't you forgive my sin? Bless me with a loving heart and a peaceful mind, and draw me into you. I am your child, your wayward child. Lord, won't you forgive my sin? Assurance of pardon. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will hardship or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? No. In all these things, we are more than conquerors through God's love. For we are convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation can separate us from the love of God in Jesus Christ our Lord.
I see Victor coming. I see Alexander. Here come more. Oh, boy. Oh, good. We've got a full house today. This is wonderful, is it not? So, my friends, I have been in prison many, many times. Does that sound a little odd? I suppose I really should say I have been to prison many, many times, because as often as I've been to prison, I've been let out about 3 hours later. And that doesn't happen for everybody inside, does it? I'm going to tell you a story from one day of my... I've been into Attica prison, which for adults is a very famous and a place where a lot of really unhappy things happened long before you were born. I've been there about 250 times in Attica prison, talking with men inside. And these have been some of the most wonderful conversations I have ever had in my whole life. Here's one. So a young man accompanied me. He was from the church I was then pastor for. And he came in with me. And he was taller than I am, very slim, and he was a graduate student at the university. And so the conversation was going along, and at one point, one of the men in the group, one of the men who was a prisoner inside, said, "Ah, what's happened to us would never happen to someone like you." Now, what they were seeing was a man with glasses, and he looked like he was studying at a university, and he was. And they just couldn't imagine that this was like their life. And then he said, one of the men said, "Oh, that's not true. When I was his age, I looked just like that. In fact, I was in college. So here was a man inside who'd been to college, and here's a man outside who was still getting more education. And the two of them looked at each other, and they really seemed to understand each other. And the one who came in with me, his name was TJ. TJ said, "Oh, I could have been here." That's what he said. "I could have been here in prison." He said, "One day when I didn't have very much money and I was pumping gas at the gas station, one of my buddies came around to the gas station and said, 'Hey, I know how you can make some money fast.'" What do you think he had on his mind? Stealing, or maybe selling drugs, something. And my friend TJ said that right then he was so tempted to go with his buddy and do whatever he had, because he didn't have any money and he needed money. And then TJ told all the group of men who were assembled, and me too, he said, "And then I thought about my mother." I think this brought tears to everybody's eyes in the whole room back then. "Then I thought about my mother and how she would feel if she learned that I made that bad choice today." And I said, "No." Now that is a really, really good reason to say no. And your mothers are sitting out here and they know that, right? What are you thinking, Otto? What a great question. Does a child sometimes think that his mother or her mother is like God? What do you think, mothers? I see some heads nodding and some sort of. Here's one way that might be, Otto, that the mother seems to be full of love and has a lot of good ideas. So some of which you don't want to follow. That sounds a little bit like God. But TJ, I'm just going to repeat that thing that he said. "Then I thought about my mother and how she would feel. And I said no to my buddy. And I went back to pumping gas." It's a really simple story. But it came from inside a prison. I want to hear what you want to say, Miranda. Well, he was earning money. But if you've ever earned any money, you might not have done that yet. But if you've ever earned money and you realize you have debts to pay for rent or whatever, money kind of comes in and goes out. The income and the outgo, all of our families struggle with that. It's not easy. So that's the answer. He didn't have enough money to pay for the things he really needed, like transportation and rent and food. Anyway, when we think about our parents and their guidance, and we hope and pray, and we know they hope and pray, that they're working with the Spirit of God and giving you instruction, and then at the times that you most need it, you may remember them, even though they're not there. Just like God is not so obviously here. I can't see God. He couldn't see his mother when he did that. But he remembered her, and he was very grateful that he'd been raised with that kind of love. Let's say a prayer. Dear God, throughout our lives, we will meet people who didn't have a lot of good guidance at the right time. And sometimes they hurt deep inside. Keep us mindful of how grateful we are for the teachers and our parents and our church, our school, all the guides, the policemen, all the people that want to help us. And let us be the helper for a person whose heart is sad. Amen. Thank you.
You.
The first reading is from the second book of Kings, chapter 2, verses 1 through 14. Now when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of prophets who were in Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." Elijah said to him, "Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. The company of prophets who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you?" And he answered, "Yes, I know. Be silent." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. 50 men of the company of prophets also went and stood at some distance from them as they both were standing by the Jordan. Then Elijah took his mantle and rolled it up and struck the water. The water was parted to the one side and to the other until the two of them crossed on dry ground. And when they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me what I may do for you before I am taken from you." Elisha said, "Please let me inherit a double share of your spirit." He responded, "You have asked a hard thing. Yet, if you see me as I am being taken from you, it will be granted. If not, it will not." As they continued walking and talking, a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them, and Elijah ascended into a whirlwind into heaven. Elisha kept watching and crying out, "Father, Father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." But when he could no longer see him, he grasped his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. He picked up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. He took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water, saying, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" When he had struck the water was parted to the one side and to the other, and Elisha went over. Our second reading is from Mark chapter 9, verses 2 through 10, from the New Revised Standard Version Bible. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up high mountain and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my son, the beloved. listen to him. Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, he ordered them to tell no one about what they had seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead could mean.
Today is traditionally called Transfiguration Sunday. That is the last Sunday before Lent begins. I will not otherwise be referring to the beginning of Lent in this sermon, but I do wish you to be reminded, perhaps again during announcements, that we have a midweek service this week, an Ash Wednesday service, and you will sense notes about the whole prospect of Lent as we move along in this particular sermon. It is the last in a series based in the prophets. And here in this reading from the Gospels, we had Moses and Elijah appearing. So it's appropriate that we use the unusual transfiguration story as a way to cap our thinking about the prophets. Two concerns troubled them: false worship and injustice. Some prophets seem to round on both of these subjects, mostly not. Most burned hot for one but not the other, for one or not the other. For example, Hosea fulminated against turning to foreign gods, while Micah, sounds like he was watching our disaster from 2009, he declares, "Woe to those who defraud a man of his home because it is in their power to do so." Now, my conscience for social justice was forged during the civil rights struggle and the war resistance of the 1960s. It was more than 20 years later that about 20 years later, I was studying the prophets in seminary, and I drank from those oracles of the social justice prophets, if we might call them that. These who called across the centuries to pull down the mighty from their thrones and exalt those of low degree. Reading Amos, who can't help but hear Martin Luther King saying from Amos, "Let justice roll down like mighty waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." Words like that I wished to help forward into yet another generation. But as for the other sorts of oracle, the kind about false worship, I wasn't interested. As we mentioned last week, all of the gods named in the Bible, the foreign gods, no one worships them anywhere on earth today. It seemed to me then that hatred for different worship practices was abstract or archaic or maybe even xenophobic. I wasn't interested. And yet, one learns, one is educated by more than just books and one's own prejudices and predilections. In our own time, the interplay of religiousness and injustice strikes a drumbeat so constant that I have long since repented of my rejection of half the prophets as not interesting. Not at all. So many Americans think of the U.S. as a Christian nation. You hear the term all the time. It can ill be defended by reference to the founding fathers, but they say it can, and they're just wrong. We're not a Christian nation, but you hear it all the time. And yet these same who say it deny with ferocious energy that our laws and our forces have assaulted and killed our own citizens by the millions, and those of other nations by the millions as well. I'm reading Ibram Kendi's large book called Stamped from the Beginning. Its subtitle will tell you something of what it's about. A Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. I had a chance to hear Kendi at the Schomburg last summer, and I've slowly been moving through this very large book since. Now, here there isn't time to tell any of its stories. I will share with you, however, an impression. It's like a concavity in my mind. It's so big and painful. Made by this book. 500 years of racist ideas. This impression. That virtually every philosopher whose thought you have been taught to admire during these 500 years, from either side of the water, every political leader, every man of affairs, every religious leader, every august academic institution, every court, every body of law, for almost 500 years. All of them rooted and grounded in racist ideas. Ibram Kendi makes this point. You cannot resist as you read the book. Grounded in racist ideas which have been waiting around the corner in every segment of our history to churn fear and profits for people of privilege in this most religious of nations. It was not until 1964, and you know what I'm referring to, the laws in this nation finally turning against the long tide of racist ideas. Once I had thought the prophets of two kinds, two passions, justice, true worship, but it's not that at all. These voices harmonize on one theme. This is what I've come to see. Only one theme. It is this. Only what is true is good, and only what is good is true. Now that sounds a little circular, but it has a profound ways to be applied. To be found false, worship hardly needs a metal idol of some non-existent being carved and placed on an altar. That's not necessary. Obviously, money could be a false god. We all often hear that. But false worship, let's speak of it in general terms. False worship proceeds wherever people use something they control to gain access to what they think of as the highest possible good. I'll repeat that. False worship is underway wherever people are using something that is in their control to lay hold of what they think of as the highest possible good. So obviously money, Jesus even calls that a god, mammon, you've heard that one. Less obvious, perhaps, are that any kind of addiction or addictive substance or behavior involves a kind of idolatry, a kind of false worship. But less obvious still is how the Bible itself becomes the object of false worship. When a religious leader or a political leader who can quote scripture, some can't, when a leader uses scriptures to put a moat around these people in order to banish those people, false worship is underway. It's totally in his control. how to use it, and say, we are the in-group. And this is a common behavior. You know, even forms of worship. But we've always done it that way. Even forms of worship can become false worship once the form matters more than access to the spirit for whom the form was formed. Well, the prophet's understanding of social justice and false religion, I think of it like an X-ray film, which you could hold up, and no matter how you turn it, the diagnosis is clear. Here are four ways to turn the prophet's X-ray scan on the diseases of a society and the health of a society. If you seek justice, you must worship God truly. If you worship God truly, justice will flow down from you like an ever-flowing stream. Turn it around. People who worship falsely are bound to be an unjust people. People who accept injustice are always engaged in false worship. These four premises are the promises of the prophets. The relationship of justice with true worship is hardwired in human nature, and it runs like this. Justice is a name for right relationships among all people. True worship is a name for right relationship between the human creature and the Creator. No surprise that Jesus says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself." True worship and justice. No wonder the prophets sometimes speak from one and sometimes from the other. These are the essential behaviors of a rightly ordered human. When from pride or from fear, creatures disorder their relationships with others, of course they ignore God. It's impossible to be in an ordered relationship with humans without remembering whence you come and why you are humble. And also that other behavior of rushing out into the world angry at all of its injustices and ignoring God. What happens then is one has only one's own judgments. One leans only upon one's own understanding and blows holes in people's relationships and the society and, frankly, burns out, usually, pretty quickly. Think of it this way. Justice and true worship are the outside and the inside of the same cup. And this is the cup by which God gives humans to drink. True worship and justice, the outside and the inside of the same cup. So come to our story. Jesus is taking three disciples up the high mountain apart. Now they've all looked in their Bibles and they've seen the colored plates with Moses on the high mountain and Elijah on the high mountain, and they know this is a big deal. You're going with the master up the high mountain? This is a big deal. And according to the stories, they go arguing. Which one of us is the greatest? According to one of the Gospels, one of the mothers intercedes and says, "Jesus, could you make my boy the greatest?" Kind of remarkable stories. Worship and justice are always the subject on the high mountain stories, not alone from the Hebrew and the Christian traditions, also from others. When Moses ascended to the high mountain, it was to get the law. Talk about a fusion of worship and justice. in our opening call to worship, we heard of Elijah huddled in his cave. He was terrified, having sought to bring justice, but King and Queen Ahab and Jezebel had chased him out. He was scared for his life, hiding in a cave. And what? It was wonderful how that was arranged, that you actually got to say it to the Elijah figure. Go back to the city. Don't stay here, up here on the high mountain. You've got a place to go. You've got something to do. So the worship of justice are there together. It's also in the story we heard, where it isn't, you'd have to have read the whole context to see that when Elijah is moving and saying, "Don't follow me. Don't follow me, young man. Don't follow me." And Elisha says, "I will too, I will too, I will too." He disobeys his master several times. But each of the places they're going to is taking them away from Jerusalem, away from ordinary religion. In fact, at this point of the story, Elijah strikes his mantle on the waters of the Jordan River and goes eastward, away from Jordan, out of the Holy Land. And there is the magical moment, the powerful moment, the mysterious moment, the transfiguration for Elijah. So the disciples know all these stories. And then there comes this experience when they're on the high mountain, the transfiguration. If you read the word in the original, it doesn't help. Don't bother. Don't need to learn. It's just a word, and it means changed. And it means, if you want a fancier word, it means transformed. But there's nothing there to help you understand or us understand what happened. The story is quiet, silent about this. So little does it say that we could say that all we really know is how the disciples are changed. Because they are. For one moment, they stop worrying about themselves. For one moment, they don't wonder whether they have, each one separately, the most favor from Jesus. For a moment, they are ecstatic. You know that word comes from two words we're all familiar with. Ek, like an exit, outside, and static, meaning standing. They're outstanding. They're standing outside themselves. They're beside themselves. That's what ecstatic means. They're beside themselves. They're not beset with themselves. For a moment, you could say, they are transfigured. They worship truly. For a moment. And then they go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like, "Jesus, this is so cool. How about we build three shrines here and say every Sunday, because Sabbath is Saturday. How about every Sunday, like we come up here and James could have the Elijah shrine and maybe John could do, maybe I could do your shrine every week." In their confusion, says the story, they did not know what to say. Stupid things. They abandon the spirit of worship for the business of religion. Making religion weekly, just like we do. It's a challenge, isn't it? It's kind of an attack on ordinary religion. Because God, or a voice from the cloud, says, doesn't say dummies, but it does say, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." It does not say, "This is my beloved son, worship him." Startling, huh? Listen to him. And what does he have to say? "We need to go back down the mountain." This is true worship in order to justice, right? The worship was true. Now we got to use it. Justice. Worship has its place, first place. It is a gift whose presence you cannot predict. The timing, you can prepare for it. That's what the symbol of ascending the mountain always is. It's preparation, like the Lent we're about to enter. Silence is the great vessel within which we prepare for true worship. But now, the power of the gift of worship will decay swiftly if it is not used for justice. Worship is for justice. Right worship is for justice. It's in all the other stories we've already shown how Moses goes down that mountain, how to set my people free, according to the story. Elijah was the first among the prophets who directly challenged a king to his face for his injustice. Now he is sent back into the fray with Jezebel and Ahab to bring a fire of justice that causes the king's rule to be ruined. Elisha, having traveled all that way into the strange, not holy land where these great things happened to him according to the legend, now himself strikes the River Jordan. You know, it's a new exodus. He is going back into the promised land, back to Jerusalem and the lands of Judea to work for the people, to heal and to repair. So the three disciples, listening to Jesus, now go down the mountain and return to their ministry. Worship is in order to justice. Throughout history, religious associations have not had a good record in hearing this teaching and living by it. Our forebears and we ourselves as a society have been tempted to accommodate injustice and domination. This happens in every land. Religion's teachers infuse believers with worldviews that accommodate to whatever powers promise them security in their body and in their stuff. We hear it right now all the time. I alone can fix it. I can keep you safe and keep those criminals away and keep your stuff, and reduce your taxes so we don't have to share. All these principles are embraced by much of the religion as well. It's been going on like this, the prophets say, since always. It's the normal pattern of religion to fall into this habit of defending the powerful. This is also why, according to the Bible stories, God chooses servants who are outside of religion. Every single one of them, whose stories have been told since you were little, if you've been going to church school, every single one of them comes from outside. Think of the ones we were talking about. Moses, an outsider. Elijah, Elisha, Jesus, Hosea, Amos, Micah, Isaiah. On and on, God chooses someone not inside the ordinary religion to break it apart. They're like blacksmiths. They're making new worship. They're using fire. And I know it hurts sometimes to feel that fire. They hammer on humans. They forge new forms of worship on the anvil that they hammer. God's will is showing up. Don't talk. Show me in various ways. Their whole hope is to bring a person to a decision. To a decision. To a moment when she sees herself connected to the whole web of humanity, of creation, really. Connected. Connected and responsible and alive to what is. Near the end of that chapter in which the Transfiguration story is told, Near the very end, Jesus is ministering again, and he heals a boy, and his disciples, who've been trying to do healings, say, "How did you do that? We couldn't do that." And he says, "This kind of evil can only be driven out by prayer and fasting." We could hear that phrase a little differently with today's thoughts. He might have said, "This kind of justice, healing, can only be worked where true worship has prepared the way." Here in this outwardly religious nation, which we inhabit, where so many say they love to tell the stories of Jesus, the people do not apparently yearn to offer health care to every person who cannot pay for it, do not yet yearn to assure an excellent education to every young mind ready and open, do not yet yearn that every working person receive a living wage, do not yet yearn that everyone without work have work, do not yet yearn that every man, every woman coming home from prison be given an opportunity to write a new life story. All this is not yet yearned for in this nation that claims so to love Jesus. The prophet's diagnosis is sharp. It is hard. It is that in such a nation, there is no true worship. There must be other gods getting in the way of the relationship with God. There must be a need yet to prepare a place for God where justice can be born. That's what the Bible says. Well, what shall we do with a judgment of that kind? Which, of course, does not apply to every individual in the same way. It's a reading of a society, which was the call of the prophets. First, no one person can change others without force. And absent divine authority, force usually distorts justice. The gift we can give the world, and I mean each one of us, the gift that we can give the world is to prepare ourselves to worship in truth. To be a sanctuary for the truth, not just in a Sunday setting, of course, but really as an aim of life, to be a sanctuary for the truth. And then we will walk with courage in paths toward justice. Amen. We're singing only the first two and the last two stanzas of the next hymn, "Take My Life and Let It Be."